Wisconsin Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Except for perhaps Justice Kroski, who at the end might stand or stay standing because she has some back issues that are better served while standing. So
thanks,
make nothing of that other than she's trying to be here and be comfortable. This morning, calling State or County of Dane versus Public Service Commission of Wisconsin, 21AP, 1321, and 1325. Could I please start out with the appearances of counsel?
Morning.
Very good. Thank you. So we start out with 15 minutes, and then 10 minutes, 30 minutes, followed by 5 minutes with Mr. Welsh, right? Okay. All right. Also this morning, we have with us Waupun High School. Could you please stand up if you're here? Good group. It's nice to see all of you, and welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. After oral arguments this morning, Justice Dallet would be the one who would be able to meet with you if time permits and you're able and wish to stay. She will talk to you not about the case, but she'll talk to you about court procedures or things like that, and you can ask her anything you would like to. So welcome this morning. It is nice to have you here. You can go ahead and have a seat. All right, then. With that, we will start up with Mr. Welsh, the first 15 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. If all that it takes to subpoena a judge is evidence that she had opportunities to do something inappropriate, then Caperton claims will no longer be exceptional. They will no longer be extraordinary, limited to extreme facts, as this court has said. They will become routine, perhaps as commonplace as motions to dismiss. And motions to produce, subpoenas, will become par for the course. Now, members of this court probably have friends, maybe even close friends, who appear before them regularly or who have interests that are implicated by this court's cases. Perhaps you belong to a small group. Perhaps you belong to a fantasy football league with these people or a book club. Perhaps you even talk with them in text or email. Perhaps even a lot because you're close friends. None of this is remotely inappropriate. Now, can we be sure that judges are always acting appropriately, that they are prudently navigating their dual roles as judges and professionals and friends? No. Can we be absolutely sure that they don't engage in improper ex-party conversation? No. But we presume that they follow the rules. We presume they are impartial, that they act with honesty, that they act according to regular procedure.
Mr. Welsh, just so we're clear about what we're reviewing here, so your client had, there's two subpoenas involved in this case. One is the subpoena for documents and the other was the subpoena to testify. Are you talking solely about the subpoena for the documents? Because he never appealed, he never raised an issue about the subpoena to testify to the lower court. I'm concerned about what we're saying here about procedure and how we handle these types of challenges.
Mr. Hitch was on the wrong side of a game of subpoena whack-a-mole. There were four subpoenas in as many months. As soon as he was subpoenaed for documents and for testimony, he moved immediately to quash, obtained a stay of the order denying that motion to quash, and the Court of Appeals was proceeding according to regular course until the other side withdrew that subpoena while that stay was in effect, and after the stay was vacated, issued another one. Our argument against all subpoenas is the same.
So you're making the same argument of a subpoena to testify as you are a subpoena for documents.
We are making many of the same arguments. Okay. And the reason is...
I'm going to take you back to what we're actually... I get your arguments, and you make them in your brief. But again, just so we stay focused, because procedure actually matters in terms of... I mean, if we follow what you're saying, and we say that someone can subpoena someone, a witness in a proceeding, can receives a subpoena to testify, and they can challenge that subpoena to the Supreme Court without ever having challenged that subpoena to the lower court, that would be quite a thing, wouldn't it?
Your Honor, non-parties challenge subpoenas in civil cases all the time. Those get denied. Not everyone ends up before this court. There are many criteria they have to satisfy before
right,
they get this court's attention.
Right, but that never was denied, right? So I guess what I'm trying to ask you, Mr. Walsh, are you asking us to review the subpoena for documents? Is that where you're focusing on, or are you saying you want us to review the newest subpoena, which was never challenged to the circuit court?
You can do either one or more. So you can view it as a challenge to the subpoena Ducis Tecum, which we challenged under 80507 and under 22757, because we, like everybody here, is arguing that Driftless cannot proceed since it has not stated a cognizable claim of bias.
I'm just going to push back on you there. That subpoena doesn't exist anymore. So how can you appeal something that doesn't even exist anymore?
Your Honor, you confront this scenario all the time in mootness cases. There's all kinds of gamesmanship that occurs because one side might not want to end up before an appellate court on an issue. So what happens is a subpoena will be issued, a stay will be entered, they'll withdraw the subpoena and say, oh, the case is moot. Then the appeal gets dismissed and they issue another one. We challenge the new one on the same grounds as we challenge the old one.
Okay,
and under mootness doctrine, the question is, this is, go ahead, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
Okay, here's the key point under mootness doctrine. This court asks, will its resolution of the issues presented have a practical effect on the controversy below? We argue, everyone on our side of the V of the case argues, that this case cannot proceed under 227.57.1, the exception to the judicial review of administrative record principle. And that's as live an issue as they get.
Well, I understand. I completely understand that, and I get that from your brief. My question is the vehicle by which you are trying to get us to do that review. And this is what I'm not understanding, is there's the subpoena for documents, which is withdrawn. Then there is the subpoena to testify, which never went before Judge Frost in Dane County.
Your Honor, it could have never happened. They knew what they were doing. The trial was days away. We had a hard enough time getting a stay from Judge Stark in less than two business days.
So let me just follow up on that, okay? I realize, so are you saying that because the subpoena was issued so close to trial, that was the problem?
Exactly.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So
it's capable of repetition yet evading review.
So, Mr. Walsh, as you probably know, in criminal cases all throughout the state, there is a really, really tight timeline between when subpoenas go out and when the trial might be. And that's for a whole bunch of different reasons. A lot of it is because there are just so many criminal cases, and DA's offices aren't always sure which case is going to go forward and which case isn't. You might not know until the Thursday before the trial what's going to go and what's not. So how would we ever limit all of those witnesses and all of those criminal cases from taking their claim right to us that they should not have to testify?
By not granting petitions for review from denials of motion to quash. I assume this court gets a fair number of petitions review from all kinds of interlocutory orders. This court rarely grants such petitions. That motion practice is common. I think it's pretty understood throughout the bar that you wouldn't go to the Supreme Court on just a garden variety motion to quash because of, you know, the witness is 61 miles beyond the courtroom or some more prosaic question of law. This case presents substantial questions of not only Wisconsin law, but federal law, and it threatens to affect regulators across the country. You have heard in this case from the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners.
I know, I've read all, and there was a lot of pages to read here. So the way you are telling me that we could limit what you are asking us to do so that every witness in Wisconsin who is subpoenaed, just to testify, not to bring documents, but just to testify, the only way to limit that is for us not to grant their petitions for review.
That would be one substantial way to do it, Your Honor. And there hasn't been a problem thus far in the history of the state. I don't think there would be a problem going forward. But the other key component, and this is critical, this is a 227-57 case. The plaintiffs, petitioners, I'll call them plaintiffs, are attempting to do something that's already extraordinary under the law. They are attempting to proceed under a very limited exception to the rule that judicial review is limited to the record before the agency. So that, right out of the gate, makes this an extraordinary case. What's more, they are claiming that an adjudicator violated the due process clause under Caperton and under this court's Facebook case, which is another big deal. It also implicates the presumptions, which are our third big deal, which operate in every case where there's speculation that a judge or adjudicator might have behaved differently. So I think there are lots of reasons this case won't inspire a flood of other garden variety challenges to subpoenas. And I think you see that in the fact that it's not just us here, Your Honor. It's everybody on the respondent side of our position in this case. They have filed briefs. You'll hear from one of them in a minute. This case raises substantial issues throughout the state. And that's a reason, Your Honor, I don't think you should be worried about it.
Counsel?
Now, yep.
Counsel, there are substantial issues that are briefed and that we are asked to resolve. But I want to start from the very beginning. And to me, the very beginning is what, it may be boring and not as interesting as some of these substantial issues, but what brings us here today? Procedurally,
mm-hmm.
Other things bring us here today, but procedurally. So we have a subpoena that required documents to be returned, a subpoena ducis tecum. That was withdrawn. The court had issued an order on it. You never appealed that order, did you? Or sought review of that order?
No. If I understand, Your Honor, we did appeal the order denying our motion to quash and our motion for an emergency stay.
And then when the circuit court vacated the order, did you appeal that?
That was after the court had issued a stay. We did not appeal that, Your Honor.
Almost.
And that's the and that's the capable of repetition problem.
Yes.
We literally couldn't. We could not get to this court any more quickly than we did.
Let me tell you one of the things that very much bothers me procedurally. Maybe boring, but bothers me. And it's this. I have never seen a case when you're dealing with a subpoena to testify that the motion wasn't brought before the circuit court first. And I'm concerned about the collateral consequences of the kind of procedure we are establishing here. To me, it is absolutely elementary. It is absolutely law 101 that if you want to not have to testify, you go before the circuit court. All of the circuit court judges here had that experience. Then you get, if you lose, then you can appeal, you can seek review. But you're not doing that. And the repercussions of this procedural maneuver, and I don't mean that pejoratively, I just, you know, this means, is of great concern to me. Can you respond why it should not be that this is okay, Judge, that we come and ask you to quash the subpoena without doing it first in the circuit court?
Well, for one, I'd note the other side has argued that we can't challenge subpoenas to testify, full stop. So how can we
okay,
do something?
Okay, well, they're wrong.
Okay, good.
Okay, so now.
That was easy.
Yeah, that's fine. Next
that
issue.
Was very helpful.
That's
thank
right.
you, Your Honor.
Give me another softball.
Okay.
That's just, what you're trying to do is an anathema to procedure and proper procedure.
Okay, here's why it isn't. One, we just established that we had the right to move to quash the subpoena ducis tecum, and then we would have had grounds to move to quash the subpoena for testimony. Those motions are brought all the time in Wisconsin courts.
I'm focusing on the testimony. That's what's before us.
Those motions happen all the time, too, Your Honor. There are motions to quash trial testimony that are filed in Wisconsin courts all the time.
I know.
Okay.
I was a circuit court judge for 10 years. You think
I want to make sure we have common ground here. So starting from the fact that that happens all the time, there are interlocutory orders that deny those motions all the time, and rarely do those interlocutory orders interest this court. Because rarely do those interlocutory orders involve questions at the heart of fairness and impartiality in adjudications and before courts.
Yes, it seems to me your argument in your briefs is we didn't bring the motion to quash before the circuit court because we thought we were going to lose. And now you say, and we can't have meaningful appeal because we don't think you're going to want it. Wow.
Reiterate this point because it's very important.
Okay, maybe I'm missing it because that seems quite extreme to me.
We had no time. We could not have done it. The judge had told us if you brought that motion, he was going to deny it. Okay, so that means we would have to go to the Court of Appeals, get a stay within hours. We would have then had to come to this court and get an emergency stay maybe within a day. It could not have been done. We already had a procedure by which to contest whether trial-related proceedings or discovery could move forward under sub 1. So we thought this would be the best way to serve judicial economy. And that's why mootness doctrine exists. So no one questions we had a right to do what we did and to appeal that order. Now, mootness doctrine asks, well, is there a good reason for us not to proceed? And the question you ask to determine that is whether your resolution of the merits issues will have a practical effect on the underlying controversy. Absolutely. It will. The circuit judge is waiting for your guidance so he can know whether he can take this to trial. The Seventh Circuit and the federal district judge in that case are waiting for this court to answer the merits questions. Sua sponte, in the fall, the Seventh Circuit ordered the district judge to abstain because this court had granted review and appeared ready to address the merits. That's why this court exists, to say what the law is so lower courts know what they're doing. You do it through your superintending authority, and you do it through the normal procedures.
Mr. Welsh, you've spent an extraordinary amount of time this morning discussing, rather than the merits, discussing essentially what the dissent to the grant order was that three of my colleagues joined. We took the case despite that dissent. So is there anything you'd like to address that deal with the merits?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I know my time is limited, so I'll focus on one point.
In fact, it's gone.
Gone. May I, Chief? I'll keep
you
it
may first. Answer my question.
This court in 2005 answered the question of what it takes to get discovery on a claim of judicial bias. That's in Martyr versus Board of Regents. The question presented, namely the third question presented in that case, presented exactly this issue. This court said that alleging that judges and parties have opportunities to do things that are inappropriate is not enough. You must make a strong showing overcoming the presumptions. That case controls here more than the Facebook case, which is also helpful, but I would urge your honors to consider the effect of Martyr on the issues here. Thank you.
Thank you. I would hope on your rebuttal, which is left at 5 minutes, we can dispense with talking about whether or not we should have taken the case and timing issues. All right. Counsel?
I think we were just trying to show the errors of the way, maybe, but you may proceed.
May it please the Court, Christiane Whiting appearing on behalf of the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. You're right to be concerned about procedure in this case. And let's think about what actually has happened here. Based on purely speculative allegations about supposed procedural irregularities before the Commission that were only raised after the Commission, DRFLA seeks to expand what the Wisconsin legislature intended to be a swift and straightforward review of an agency decision based on the record before that agency into full-blown discovery and trial, including asking a public official to turn over his personal cell phone for inspection. They didn't even bring their request to expand the record until after the case was fully briefed before the circuit court, 10 days before oral argument on the merits. And importantly, there is nothing irregular about anything that Driftless claims that Mr. Hipsch did that entitles them to blow up the record.
Counsel, looking at the statute, which is 227.57 sub 1, it talks about in cases of alleged irregularities. It's very interesting to me that that word alleged is here. Many times in statutes we'll see except in cases of irregularities, but here they are alleged irregularities. So how else would they have alleged these irregularities other than to make the claim? And then the statute goes on to talk about discovery as a possible way of determining the claim. How else would this work? Can you tell me what you think about that?
There's a pleading standard for any claim brought to the courts, right? Before you bring a claim, particularly where it's as damaging in and of itself of a judicial bias claim or a fraud claim, you have to have some kernel beyond that allegation. There has to be some, it can't be pure speculation. But here, it is purely speculative. They took allegations of him working in the industry, which is publicly available and widely known, and claim that that entitles them to just look into everything.
Well, what about the encrypted messages? Maybe where you work, given the industry, isn't really the troubling part here. But what about those encrypted messages that were brought to light by the attorneys in this case? That's who brought this all to light, the attorneys.
A couple points about that. First, Judge Frost at the time was supposed to be looking at the scope of the proceeding below. The information that came in about encrypted messages was because the federal court was erroneously allowed them to do discovery, which the Seventh Circuit then said was not proper. They never should have proceeded to discovery in the federal court. So at the time that they made their allegations in the circuit court, all they had was that he worked with MISO, and they said that was problematic. Subsection 227.574 also says that it has to be a material procedure error for you to remand to the commission. And Section 19, or Chapter 19, says that there are public records obligations, but that purely personal communications are not a business record. And it specifically defines that purely personal communications do not have to be preserved, and they have nothing to do. You can have a private life and be a public servant. So he didn't have an obligation to preserve those, particularly if they were about the Packers or health concerns. That's a red herring. I understand why it looks dangerous, but the nature of the communications should not be disturbing. The Martyr case, they went on a private plane onto the very hearing where the individual who was challenging that was terminated. And they said, no, you don't get to look at that. Even if that looks highly suspicious, and they were going to drive separately, and they said, hey, wait a minute, I know, let's get on my private plane and go together. And they still said, you don't get discovered to ask whether they had talked about the case. You similarly don't get to ask to look at every personal communication that Commissioner Hifsch had with individuals who were somehow tangentially related to a party before him. When Mr. Hifsch did get a communication that came close to the line of potentially being an ex parte communication, he revealed it. He got a text message from a Michigan commissioner, and he immediately said, look, I received this, gave everybody an opportunity to respond. And that's the concern here, right? It's that if there is a communication about the docket, there has to be an opportunity to respond. Even if there are ex parte communications, they're not always fatal for the decision if the other party has an opportunity to respond. Here, they're purely speculating that by engaging in his duty to be an informed public official, Commissioner Hifsch talked to people in the industry. That's what he's supposed to do. And they're saying, based on that, we should go into every communications he's ever had and see if anything suspicious happened. That's not the law.
Counsel, I agree that in fact, under the statute, you're supposed to have interaction with people in the industry. I understand that. This is my concern. Help me ameliorate my concern. On page 17 of the brief, the red brief, but there's so many red briefs here. Anyway, of the petitioner respondent and intervener respondent, Driftless and Land Conservancy, etc., page 17. They give this as the background, and this caused me concern. Counsel for ATC and ITC announced Hipsch's use of this encryption during the pendency of the contested case proceeding. The encryption was used during the pendency. With lobbyists for two of the transmission companies that were party to that docket and a parent company. And I know that they apparently, according to these facts, did it because they saw some reference to Signal in a text message. But what compelled the lawyers to disclose this? Is that in the record?
I believe in the ATC and other co-owners brief, I think it's at page 40, but I can find that record site, they do say that they did this not as an admission of anything untoward, but because this would open an even bigger can of worms, and they wanted to get the project constructed.
I thought that was why they asked then that there be a whole new hearing, vacate the prior ruling and have a whole new hearing, because let's move on. Time is of the essence. What I don't understand, and my concern is that it deals with any kind of reporting duty for ex-party communications. I mean, it's unusual that counsel would disclose encryption. In this instance, to me, it seems unusual. So I'm trying to figure out if the record reflects why they felt obligated to disclose it when no one else knew about it.
I mean, I think the discovery request, and again, this was a discovery request served on the counsel to the owners, so I can't speak exactly for what that was, but would have asked for all communications, and so they were going to have to disclose all communications based on what the circuit court had said was going to be expansive and practically unlimited discovery. And I think, based on their brief, they thought that it was going to take forever to do extensive discovery on something that has nothing to do with anything and wanted to get construction going. And so that's what they say in their brief for why they made the business decision to ask for rescission. But I can't speak entirely for what the co-owners' counsel was thinking.
Thank you.
So if the circuit court's handling of this case is allowed to be is affirmed, the presumption of impartiality that we owe to administrative adjudicators will be eliminated. And the burden is going to be shifted to decision makers to prove that they were not biased in every case. Public officials will be handcuffed in performing their duty to be informed public servants. And the burden of proving they may not want to participate in public service at all. Those that stay in public service could be colored in their decisions out of fear that a very litigious party, if they don't like the decision, is going to try to get invasive discovery from their family and friends based on nothing.
Counsel, do you agree that the standard is serious risk of actual bias that would need to be shown, and your argument is that that wasn't shown here?
Yes.
I heard you say that all they had in front of them at the time was his relationships with other people.
They have to overcome the presumption of impartiality, honesty, and integrity.
But
they
no one's trying to challenge that standard. You agree that that's the standard?
Serious risk of actual bias.
Okay.
Bias. Yes. If the court has no further questions, I'll take my seat.
All right, go ahead. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Barrett Van Sicklin of DeWitt LLP. I didn't have a chance to introduce Carlos Papelbon, Deputy Counsel for Dane County, seated behind me, and Frank Jablonski, representing Iowa County, Town of Wyoming, and the Village of Montford, is also seated behind me. And by agreement among the respondents, I'll be handling this morning's argument. Now, the discussion started this morning a little bit with some of the procedural issues. And I want to make one quick point about procedural issues that's a little bit more nuanced than what we were discussing a little bit ago. Now, there was some reasonable disagreement among the justices about whether granting review was appropriate, given that this was a non-party witness. But Mr. Hipsch's notice of appeal to the Court of Appeals was specific and narrow, challenging only the denial of his motion to quash the discovery subpoena.
Now at the Supreme Court, and I'm sure you're well aware, we will take whatever we think is important to this case.
Understood. And my point is that his petition for review was handled under Rule 809.62, governing review of decisions arising from the Court of Appeals. And if you wanted to challenge these other important issues, there is a mechanism by which to do so, and that's by seeking bypass or invoking original jurisdiction to have the court review other things that wasn't before the Court of Appeals. And I submit that parties like Mr. Hipps should not be permitted to expand appellate jurisdiction at the top just to gain review of trial court proceedings that the party didn't appeal at the outset in their notice of appeal to the Court of Appeals. So it's my position that we're talking about an appeal of a discovery subpoena that was withdrawn, that Mr. Hipps never had to comply with, that two separate panels at the Court of Appeals, all six judges, have all found to be moot. That's what this appeal is about. It's moot. They then
if
say,
we thought it was moot, we probably wouldn't have taken the case, so maybe we'll move along and talk about the substance of your claims at this point, counsel.
Sure. I'll move along to the merits. I think everyone agrees that that the standards in Caperton and BJM apply. There's no disagreement amongst respondents, amongst my colleagues seated here. We all agree that Caperton applies. And what does Caperton say? It says the inquiry is an objective one. The court asks not whether the judge is actually subjectively biased, but whether the average judge in his position is likely to be neutral or whether there is an unconstitutional potential for bias. So there's no need for respondents to show actual bias. The court said...
it's a serious risk of actual bias. What facts can you tell me that are in the record that shows a serious risk that Commissioner Hipps was biased?
Serious risk of actual bias.
That's right.
Sure. The facts that are in the record, we're talking about hundreds of phone calls with senior officials at the transmission companies while the proceeding is pending.
You think you shouldn't have talked to anybody in the transmission company?
You asked me to talk about some of the facts. That's one of the facts.
Facts that show a serious risk of actual bias. So you're telling me, well, he had hundreds of phone calls, okay? Well, people have a lot of phone calls, and if you're in a position of public service, you're certainly going to have a lot of phone calls. But you have to tell me more than that
sure.
He had a number of phone calls.
And there is more than that, Your Honor. There is, you know, while the proceeding is before him, he's serving on the advisory committee of MISO.
Wasn't he appointed by the PSC to be the PSC's representative of MISO?
He was, but then where it crosses the line is that MISO, which is extraordinarily rare for this to happen, intervened as a party in the underlying proceeding, strongly advocating in favor of the transmission line. And while on the advisory committee, MISO enters into a common interest and joint litigation agreement with all three transmission companies so they could litigate together.
Is MISO governed by federal law or state law?
I believe it's federal.
Okay. And are the procedures that they employ in regard to who serves on MISO contained within federal law or state law?
Your Honor, I don't know. Sitting right here right now, I'd be happy to follow up with you within 24 hours.
You don't need to follow up. What I'm trying to point out to you is I don't see why MISO is a big deal.
I think it's a big deal when you're presiding over a proceeding in which there's a party that's litigating in front of you, and you are essentially a member of that party.
MISO is in charge of the grid in the center of our country, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and could the PSC do anything with new lines that didn't affect that grid?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. But he's serving on the committee. They're in front of him, litigating in front of him. They have a common interest in joint litigation agreement. And then as soon as the line, the permit is granted, he resigns from the commission and applies to be CEO of one of the transmission companies.
Now, that's dairyland, and that was after the matter had been determined by the PSC. So he should maybe just have not gotten another job? I mean, you know, I really am a bit amazed by the devotion we have of people that serve on administrative agencies like the PSC. And I respect your wish to challenge everything they do. I think that's important too. But I can understand why, after a particular period of time, they would want to get off and do something else. Do you find fault that after he was off, he applied to be the CEO of Dairyland, and Dairyland refused his application?
That is one of the facts that the court can take under consideration when it applies the standards set forth in Caperton and BJM.
Why would that show a serious risk of actual bias?
I think that in BJM, we're talking about a judge and a litigating party in which we have a handful of likes and comments of posts. And this court found that to be extreme facts, such that there was a serious risk of bias. And here we're talking about, you know, hundreds and thousands of reminders from the party appearing before him saying, look at me, you know what I want. And please give it to me. I mean, that's the serious risk of bias. And frankly,
I think that's what a party always does before a court. Just like you're arguing to us, saying, here's what I want, please give it to me, right? Same thing.
Well, I think what we're saying is that we should have a hearing in front of the trial court to be able to put on evidence, make a record, and demonstrate to the trial court why we've met our burden of showing that there was a serious risk of bias here. And then Mr.
Bias, and where does this fall under 227.57 sub 1? What part are you relying on?
We're relying on the part that says that if there is an irregularity in the proceeding, that you're entitled to discovery. And an irregularity
in the proceeding before the commission, correct?
Excuse me?
It's an irregularity in the proceeding before the commission.
Correct.
And the fact that Mr. Huge applied for a job with Dairyland Power after he left the PSC, you're telling me, is a fact that shows an irregularity in the proceeding before the commission?
Yes.
Why? He was already off the PSC.
I think that's a fact that we're entitled to put on before the trial court to and let the trial court make its decision as to whether or not we've met our burden. I mean, I think we're forgetting about where the posture of this case sits. We're talking about we've stated a cognizable claim for the claim to move forward. And now Mr. Hipsch wants to come along and say, well, none of these things should matter. Don't look here. And so I shouldn't have to show up and testify. But that's not for Mr. Hipsch to decide. That's for the trial court to decide after both sides have been given an opportunity to make a record, present evidence, call witnesses, and let the trial court decide. And that's what we're asking.
But the trial court made its decision with a different standard than I think you've agreed applies. Serious risk of actual bias was not the trial court's standard that was applied here.
I think the trial court applied the standards set forth in Caperton and BJM.
It never said those words. In fact, it said, what, appearance of bias? Oh, that's just semantics. Isn't that one of the things the trial court said?
I believe he did use those words, Your Honor. I do think that under a reasonable view of what the trial court was saying when he was allowing the claims to go forward, he did apply the standards set forth in BJM and Caperton. He said these are the cases that apply, and he applied it to the facts in allowing the claim to move forward.
What are the extreme facts here?
Yes.
The objectively extreme facts here. In Caperton, I think the court, no less than 20 sometimes, maybe, used that phrase, extreme, extraordinary. It was a highly unusual factual situation. So what is the highly unusual fact situation that directly bears on the issue before this judge?
Sure.
That judge in that case sat on that case that was appealed and likely to end up before that judge in that scenario where that judge's election, the court determined, was directly funded by the party in that case.
Yes. And in the BJM case, we're talking about a Facebook friendship that lasted 25 days.
I'm aware of the facts of that case, so you don't have to remind me. But I'm just trying to figure out where the extreme facts are, like Caperton.
Okay. And those facts are hundreds of phone calls, hundreds of text messages, meetings, dinners, golfing, social events with senior officials at the transmission companies, serving on the formal advisory committee of MISO that was a party to the proceeding.
But that's required by federal law, and even the circuit court judge said, I don't see how being part of this MISO entity and process that's set out and anticipated under law and under procedure, I just don't see how I could ever find that would lead to a bias. What strikes me about this case is that the circuit court appeared to allow a fishing expedition, which our cases are quite clear is not allowed, because there is a presumption that adjudicators adjudicate with integrity, impartially, and without bias. And what I hear your client alleging is a lot of suspicions about what the commissioner in this case might have said, might have done, how he might have interacted improperly with various entities. But what I don't see is any proof of that. And I know that that was the whole point of your discovery, but explain to me how that is not a fishing expedition based on mere suspicion. I don't see how you meet your heavy burden in this case, counsel.
Your Honor, I think it's more, there was a couple questions there which I won't get to. The first was just serving on MISO. And I think it's more than just serving on MISO. We're talking about MISO intervened as a party in the underlying proceeding, which is highly unusual. If it's just being a member of MISO, maybe that's not as, doesn't weigh as heavily in favor of us. But the fact that while on the advisory committee, MISO intervenes in the proceeding in front of him, and then MISO enters into a joint defense and common interest arrangement.
Why didn't you object to that during the proceeding then? Because if that were such a big issue and a reason for recusal, then that should have been raised during the proceeding instead of putting all of the parties and the commissioners through a proceeding, seeing what decision you get, and only then objecting to what you already knew had happened.
I think, Your Honor, respectfully, we knew that he was on the committee. I don't think we were aware that he had a common interest in joint litigation agreement. And he didn't disclose anything to any of the parties, nor did any of the transmission companies, while the proceeding was going on. So these are not factors that could have been raised while the proceeding was going on because they didn't know about
it. Who had a joint litigation agreement? Commissioner Hipsch wasn't part of a joint litigation agreement. He was the commissioner.
MISO had a joint litigation agreement with the three transmission companies. And so I respectfully believe that the trial court viewed the, you know, we stated a cognizable claim under Caperton and BJM, and if viewed in the light most favorable to us, because we're talking about this initial pleading stage, if we're talking about, well, now we've heard all of the evidence and both sides have had an opportunity to put stuff on, you didn't meet your burden. I think what the trial court said is, if you look at all of these facts, you've stated a cognizable claim under Caperton and BJM to allow yourself to move forward. And so, you know, this is a, that would be a determination of the trial court's discretion here to allow it to go forward.
So what's the stopping point? My colleagues at the other end of the bench were talking about what's the stopping point for allowing Commissioner Hipsch in this case to come in and challenge a subpoena for testimony. What's a logical stopping point? Can any party then in any criminal, civil proceeding, administrative proceeding say, oh, I saw the judge at some event with counsel to a party with a case before that judge, so I'm going to go to a circuit court and try to get discovery of all the judge's possible communications just because I saw the judge at an event with counsel to a party to a proceeding before the judge? What's the stopping point, counsel?
I think it's more than just mere allegations here. You need to state a cognizable claim that if those facts are true, then you've stated a claim to allow your case to move forward.
If what facts are true? That somebody happens to be at the same event as somebody else? Or they were friends 20 years ago, so they still stay in touch and have some text communications about, oh, how's your family doing? How are, you know, what's going on with your kid's sports team?
And that's
enough?
That's Mr. Hipsch's defense. I think our claim would be that there's more than just those types of communications going on, and that's why we are entitled to have a hearing on it.
What were the communications? What proof do you have that the communications were something beyond that sort of thing? Because the issue is not any communications that Commissioner Hipsch might have had with others with an interest in this case is whether they had ex parte communications. Have you identified any ex parte communications? Because that has to relate to the subject matter of the proceeding, and they had to have occurred while that proceeding was going on, right?
What you need to allege is that there's an opportunity. You know, it's not whether or not bias occurred or that the communications were about the Packers or about how to best cook a bratwurst. It's if you look at all of the facts objectively, that whether the average judge is in a position to likely be neutral or whether there is an unconstitutional potential.
You're talking about opportunity. You know, in a couple weeks, I think all of us have been invited, all the judges in the state have been invited to attend judges' nights. There's all kinds of lawyers who are going to be, hundreds of people show up to these events. Inevitably, lawyers might have interactions with any of my colleagues who might attend or any of my colleagues on the circuit court bench or the Court of Appeals. There's opportunity there too, counsel. That can't be enough, can it?
Well, it's not just, you know, the lawyers. These are the actual parties that are litigating in front of Mr. Hipsch. And it goes beyond all of the, I mean, even the transmission companies themselves asked the Public Service Commission in its letter to, quote, preserve the transparency, fairness, and integrity of the regulatory and judicial proceedings, and they asked the Public Service Commission to rescind the permit.
It seems to me like part of the problem you have in answering Justice Rebecca Bradley's questions is that you are conflating appearance of impropriety with actual due process violations of a constitutional sense. So it cannot be that you could file a lawsuit saying, I think there is impropriety, and so I would like to have discovery of this judge to see whether or not I'm right. And because of that appearance of impropriety, that's enough to allow the case to go forward on an actual bias, due process, constitutional violation. That's part of the problem I think you're having with answering Justice Bradley's question. Does that help you in a way to try to answer the question differently? Otherwise, you could file a lawsuit any time. I mean, especially think of judges in small towns. People know people. I mean, not every place is Dane County in Milwaukee. In fact, most of the state quite is not. And people know a lot of people in towns. And if it were as easy as, oh, I saw the judge golfing, or the judge has breakfast at this place every day, or, you know, that's what happens in small towns. Why wouldn't each of those arise to the kind of challenge that you're alleging here?
I think where we start is with Caperton. And what Caperton says is that there's no need to show that the judge was actually biased. All you need to show is that under a realistic appraisal of psychologic tendencies and human weaknesses, there is an actual risk of bias.
Maybe I've just written too much on Caperton, but, you know, Caperton was essentially the court saying there is so much here that it's the equivalent of actual bias, such that it rises to the level of a due process violation. And the court many, many times cited to the extreme facts in that case. How is it that we just allow someone to allege appearance of impropriety and then see what comes and see if they find that there's enough to argue Caperton? How can that be the standard in this kind of lawsuit without completely watering down what Caperton actually said based upon its facts?
What it said was that, and I think we all agree that that's the standard that applies here, so I won't get into that standard again, but it's not if there's actual bias. Again, it's if there is a potential for bias or a
serious risk
of bias.
Serious risk,
right.
Counsel. Those are the
right
words out of the case.
Correct.
Not
serious
potential
risk of bias. And here, the respondents have stated a cognizable claim that if viewed in the light most favorable to respondents, that would be a violation of Caperton and BJM. And
the judge in Caperton got, I believe, over $1 million in campaign contributions during his election when a case was pending before him from the party to that case, and then he ruled in favor of that party who had given him over $1 million in campaign contributions. The U.S. Supreme Court said those are extreme facts. That was a fact known to the party. What facts do you have beyond suspicions to support your claim?
I think I've stated those facts already, but I do want to remind this court that in BJM, which is this court's case, that's Caperton case, is that we're talking about a Facebook friend request and a Facebook friendship that lasted less than a month.
But it was going on during a custody dispute. What is more heartrending to both parents than to be involved in a custody dispute? We don't have any emotionality like that that's involved in a new transmission line, Counselor?
Well, I would say that it's, I think my side would disagree that it's very emotional to them.
but not in
respectfully,
the same way as a custody dispute.
I think the point is that this court found that a Facebook friendship that lasted less than a month and consisted of a handful of likes of comments was extreme enough facts that there was serious risk of bias.
But it was during the month when the judge was hearing testimony and making a decision about which parent would have custody of their child.
Right. And here, instead of 16 likes, we got hundreds of likes in phone calls. We got thousands of text messages.
Counsel, can I ask you a different question?
You may.
I think you've given all of your points toward that at this point. So, counsel on the other side had an interesting point that I thought she raised with respect to sub 4 of 227.57. And so it has to be a material error in procedure or a failure to follow prescribed procedure. Here, there are three individuals on the commission. And so even if Mr. Hipsch was having some communications that you've detailed, why is that material when it still would have been the same result, I assume, with the two others? It's three people, so two out of three is enough. So why does this matter? That's my question.
I believe that there were allegations against, other irregularities that happened at the Public Service Commission than just these. And I think that, and that the entire panel was tainted by Mr. Hipsch's potential for bias.
They couldn't talk about the case before. My colleagues and I can talk about the cases before we decide them. That wasn't the case. They could only talk to each other by law. They could only talk to each other during the proceeding. So when they showed up for the proceeding to make that decision, that was the first time they had talked to each other, unless you're going to say that there are suspicions that they had inappropriate conversations among each other before the proceeding. Are you making that claim?
First of all, I think that Judge Frost has already decided this issue, and no party has appealed those decisions with respect to that claim.
How do you think he decided it?
Excuse me?
How do you think he decided it?
I believe that the circuit court found that the respondents had stated a cognizable claim to allow discovery to go forward under Caperton and BJM.
That's different than Justice Bradley's question to you, though.
Can you please restate the question?
Yes, it's my understanding that the commissioners are unable by law to have conversations with each other until the actual proceeding. So I'm not understanding how you could say that Commissioner Hipsch tainted the other commissioners because they couldn't discuss it until they were in public at the hearing together. So my question was whether you are also claiming that the three commissioners had inappropriate communications with each other before the proceeding.
I don't think we are saying that, Your Honor. I think what we're saying is that what the case law says is that if one of the commissioners has violated our due process, then the entire commission is tainted, and that's enough under case law. So you don't need to prove that the entire panel there was a serious risk of bias of the entire panel. It's enough to demonstrate, to show that one was.
But they came to the proceeding with their after hearings were held, after the testimony was heard, and I understand this was a days-long process, as many trials end up being, they came to the proceeding, when they gave their decision, with pre-prepared explanations of how they were going to vote. And until that time, they were prohibited from having any communications with each other, which means that their individual decisions were arrived at without any input from each other. Do you disagree with that?
I do not disagree with that.
Where's the taint?
I'm saying is that if one of the commissioners violated the respondent's due process, then the entire proceeding can be challenged under this 227 review for a due process claim. You don't need to show that the entire panel was violating their due process rights. No.
Counsel, if we don't agree with you that you have stated a colorable Caperton claim, where does that leave you?
Well, first, I would say that we're talking about an appeal of a discovery subpoena, talking about this is moot. Second, we're saying that the issuance of a trial subpoena doesn't save their mootness claim. And third, if you say that they didn't, you know, if you wanted to provide some clarity for the trial court to use with respect to what standards it should apply in the underlying proceeding, that's certainly your right to do so. And then the trial court would move forward with the evidentiary hearing using the standards that you've sort of provided to it.
You know, I care a lot about procedure. I've written a lot about that. But mootness concerns do seem to exist for precisely cases like this. Would you at least agree that, the mootness exceptions, would you at least agree that this is a pretty dramatic circumstance that would have a huge effect on the functioning of state government and state agencies? Opening this up a little bit, I mean, there's debates about, you know, how far you take Caperton and where it means, and I've written on that as well already, but this seems to me to be a pretty dramatic change, and I think the Public Service Commission's attorney made that point in her briefing as well. Would you at least agree that this raises some significant questions of statewide importance to the functioning of state government?
I think we're talking about the issuance of a subpoena. No, I disagree.
Certainly not the issuance of a subpoena, but we're talking about something far more than that, I assume, by the many people in this room today, I would think.
I think that there's been, if you're talking about, does this open up some, is this a slippery slope that opens up an opportunity to drag other judges through the mud? Is that what you're asking me?
I'm talking about the mootness concerns in general. Mootness, obviously this is an unusual procedural posture, but, you know, we did take the case aware of some of those procedural issues. In part because this goes to the core of the way state government operates. It goes to the core of significant questions about how due process and those types of claims might apply in a situation like this. Those are incredibly significant. Any decision we would render on these underlying concerns would obviously affect the totality of the remainder of the litigation, right?
I would say that the exceptions to the mootness doctrine don't apply in this case, and I think that was articulated well by the Court of Appeals, and I don't think there's any need for this court to further clarify the mootness doctrine.
Do you see the danger in the, to be frank, it seems like Pandora's box you're opening here with some of these due process claims you're alleging here, and I know maybe we beat this with a dead horse a little bit, but put this in the context, you know, of a judge, you know, handling this. Maybe it's easier for us to sympathize with that because we wear, you know, these robes. But, you know, judges are friends with attorneys, they're friends with businesses, you know, all the time. I'm in a fantasy football league with one of my former clerks who's argued before the court. I've won 2 years in a row. This happens all the time. We text, we've done meals together. I've been to his house, he's been over to mine. This is a dramatic intrusion. If somebody asked for my phone records with my former clerk because we had an opportunity to talk about a case before us, which of course we never have, that really does seem to be Pandora's box and a real legitimate danger to the functioning of adjudicators everywhere.
I see that my red light's on, so do you mind if I respond to your question?
You may answer.
Thank you. I respectfully disagree. I think that we've had 13 years since this court heard BJM, and I'm not aware of any other case coming before this court with similar facts. And that I do believe that these facts are extreme, and that when litigants make those sort of claims, they are going to be handled just like a trial court would handle any other claim by determining whether or not a litigant has stated a claim. And again, here we're not talking about friendships with lawyers. We're talking about hundreds and thousands of communications and contacts with the actual party that's litigating before you. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Walsh?
Mr. Walsh, while you're making your way up there, can you help me understand your position as it relates to the Gilbert case, please? Is my mic on?
Can you
help me understand your position as it relates to the Gilbert case? Because as I read that case, it says that it relates only to a subpoena for documents and not a subpoena to testify.
So very briefly, State versus Gilbert has to do with motions to quash subpoenas that seek testimony. We challenged a subpoena for documents and for things, his phone, so Gilbert doesn't apply. And then the response is, well, that dispute is moot, and to which we would counter, it isn't, because resolving it will have an effect on the underlying controversy and will meet several other mootness exceptions, including voluntary cessation and capable of repetition pending review. And then also under 804.01, we challenge the subpoena, and we're more broadly challenging the subpoena under 227.57. I'd like to make 4 points before I sit down. First, regarding this business about ephemeral messaging, billions of people around the world use apps on their phone that are capable of encryption and that are capable of auto-deleting messages over a certain amount of time. Signal, Instagram, Facebook Messenger, iMessage, the default application on the iPhone, along with probably at least 50 others. There are rules. There are rules for government officials. You have to comply with the open records law. Nobody's arguing Mr. Hipsch didn't. And you can't engage in improper ex-party communications. No one's pointing to facts suggesting that Mr. Hipsch violated that rule. In fact, as my colleague pointed out, when he got an ex-party communication during the proceeding, he reported it. Second, on this business about MISO, interstate transmission does not happen in the United States unless MISO approves it. And MISO can't approve it unless it gets the approval of the federal government. Its relationship to the state utility boards is highly regulated at the federal level. Nobody's arguing that Mr. Hipsch had anything to do with the decision to intervene. MISO, by the way, intervenes routinely in state regulatory proceedings. I counted 9 from the last 5 or so years. At docket 302, page 12, note 5, you'll see MISO's governing tariff, which says that the planning staff makes decisions about intervention, has nothing to do with the advisory committee, who the MISO board doesn't even have to listen to. A second point on MISO, Justice Rebecca Bradley brought up the quote from the transcript where Judge Frost says, frankly, I don't think you have a claim on MISO, but I'm going to allow discovery anyway. That's getting the presumptions exactly backwards. If there's no claim, there should be no discovery. These claims are burdensome in their own right. Simply having an allegation that you've acted inappropriately as a government official is very serious. As Justice Rogensack pointed out, how many government officials are going to be eager to sign up for the PSC after this case?
Counsel, this could be a very, very big case, as in huge, or it can be circumscribed. And one way to circumscribe decisions sometimes is doing it under a statute as opposed to Constitution. The Constitution, that's the biggie. What about 227.57 sub 4? What's your argument with regard to that scope of review statute? It's advanced that there is no material error, and I understand that argument, but what about the other, or failure to follow a prescribed procedure?
Right. So the understanding that no one's challenging here is that irregularities in procedure under the Court of Appeals decision in Bracegirdle can encompass violations of the Due Process Clause. So we all take for granted that, and Martyr shows, that you at least have an opportunity to argue a violation of due process under 227.57.1.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be that argument. I mean, it can be.
Actually, Bracegirdle says it's procedural irregularities and due process is one, it's all-encompassing. And that's all there is.
For instance, if there were a violation of an ex-party communication, you could analyze that under due process, which is, I suppose, the gravamen of it, or you can analyze it under our codes, SCRs, 20 for lawyers and 60 for judges, right? So my point is, it doesn't have to be. You think it does?
Well, Your Honor, we say in civil procedure that the plaintiff is the master of her complaint. The petitioners are the master of their petition for review. They're arguing that there was a violation of 227 because the Due Process Clause was violated. Mm-hmm. I suppose they could have made 100 other arguments, but that's the one they've made, and so that's why we're here. And that's why the Seventh Circuit is telling the federal district judge to not move forward on the case, because it understands this court's going to answer those questions. I'd like to...
You need to wrap it up.
Okay, I'd like to leave you with this, Your Honor. Justice Rebecca Bradley quoted the language about fishing expeditions, which is the language that this court has used going back decades. The transparent attempt to use the discovery process as a fishing expedition to uncover evidence of bias is precluded by the presumptions. We have been here for 2 years. There are two other cases that are related, including a federal case. There hasn't been just one fishing expedition. They have been angling for a long time. They've hit every lake in Wisconsin. They've used every lure in their tackle box, and they have caught nothing. We ask you to declare an end to this open season, and more than that, to hold that they never had a validly issued license in the first place. Thank you.
For the record, Wisconsin has more lakes than Minnesota. All right, we're going to adjourn and then begin the next case when we've had the lawyers come in and get set up. Have a nice